The matter of State versus RY. May we please have appearances of counsel? Good morning and welcome, counsel. Ms. Romeo, please.
May it please the court. Your honors, I would like to rely on my arguments in the briefs for the second and third points and focus my argument here on the first issue unless the court has questions on those. Your honors, defendant is not asking the court here to create a new rule or to extend the law or to expand a constitutional right. He is simply asking that the law be applied correctly to the circumstances of his case and that his constitutional right to confrontation and his right to present a complete defense be honored. He was denied a fair trial because he wasn't allowed to present evidence that pointed to third-party guilt and impeached the credibility of a key witness. That evidence was contained in the paragraph of a Dreyfus report from caseworker Thomas DeAngelis. We recognize that this case is unusual because the appellate division did not have that report in front of it when it rendered its decision. And it's unclear in some ways whether the trial court did, but this court has the report now. The report contained admissible evidence of third-party guilt. The defendant was accused of digitally penetrating two young girls who were 5 and 7 years old with his fingers. But the 7-year-old had told the Dreyfus worker that the only person who ever touched her in a bad touch part was defendant's 9-year-old stepson, Darren, who she used to play with when she was being babysat by defendant's wife. The jury was never allowed to hear that. I think when we look at how the accusations in this case unfolded, we can see how important that evidence was to the defense. According to the mother's trial testimony, the first thing that happened here was Brianna is dancing around the living room. She's giving herself a wedgie, and her mother says, don't do that. She tells her mom, well, Uncle Rich lets me do that, and she also says he touches her down there, pointing. That's it. That's all she says. And then Sherry says to her mother, he does it to me too. We know from the mother that Sherry has a processing delay. We don't know whether or not Sherry, and the mother says Sherry's in the kitchen. We don't even know whether Sherry saw the gesture. We don't know whether she's reacting to the wedgie statement or anything else. So that's all the mother testifies to. And then we know that the mother leaves the two girls. She tells the older sister, who's 17 years old, about this accusation from Brianna. And what Sherry said. And she leaves the girls with the older sister. She goes to work. She doesn't call Dreyfus. She doesn't call the police. But the next day, Sherry's interviewed by caseworker DeAngelis. And caseworker DeAngelis is questioning her in the context of these allegations, which he has heard. So he phrases all of his questions in terms of where is a bad touch, where is a good touch. And when he asks her if anyone has touched her in the bad touch part, Sherry says it was her cousin Darren that he did it once. And when she's asked if anyone else has touched her in a bad touch part, she denies. Now, a couple of hours later, she's interviewed by Detective Woodfield. And at this point, the mother also tells us that she'd had several conversations with the girls before this happened. And when Sherry's interviewed now, she says, she identifies defendant as having touched her in his special spot with his finger. Woodfield never asks Sherry about what Sherry had said about Darren. She never pursues that. She never clarifies that. So the jury was never allowed to hear that Sherry had first identified someone else as the person who touched her in a bad touch part, and they were never allowed to hear that the state never followed up on those accusations. This evidence was admissible as third-party guilt evidence because it satisfies all the tests for admissibility of third-party guilt evidence. There was a link between the evidence and the victim and the evidence and the crime, and the evidence had a rational tendency to engender a reasonable doubt with respect to an essential feature of the state's case. We have the victim directly saying someone else had touched her in a bad touch part. And that was essentially what defendant was on trial for. It was what he was accused about. The evidence also complied with the evidence rules because it was a prior inconsistent statement. It was inconsistent with their video testimony, it was inconsistent with her trial testimony, and it would have been admissible if she had made it while testifying. Extrinsic evidence of that statement was admissible under Rule 806 in terms of the video testimony because under that rule, when a hearsay statement is admitted, statement or conduct that is inconsistent with the hearsay statement is admissible, even though the declarant had no opportunity to explain or deny it. And we also certainly would argue that it was if you were just looking at the trial testimony, which we're not here because we had extensive testimony, hearsay testimony from Sherry and Brianna that was admitted. We also would argue that it was admissible under 613 because that rule allows for the admissibility of evidence that unless it's excluded within the judge's discretion. And in this particular case, we certainly would argue that it was admissible under that rule. And that concludes my opening statement, Your Honors.
With regard to that last point, did the defense satisfy the requirements of Rule 613?
Well, 613 is a discretionary rule. It's a rule that basically is set up so that statements are included unless the trial judge excludes it. So in this particular instance, Sherry was not confronted with the statement, but certainly it would be very difficult with a young child like that in order to show them a Dyfus statement to refresh their recollection, which is what we would have done if she were an adult, perhaps. But
there was no question asked, even. Did you identify someone else? Set aside showing the report, there were other ways to approach this, and that wasn't attempted either, was it?
Well, the defense counsel asked her if she remembered, and saying if she remembered telling the Dyfus worker, and she said, I don't remember. He asked her that. He came at that from a couple of different angles, and she didn't remember. But even if that rule was not fully satisfied, certainly 806 was satisfied because we had large amounts of hearsay statement, hearsay evidence from Sherry that was admitted through the video testimony. And under 806, that the evidence of her prior inconsistent statement would be admitted whether or not she had the opportunity to explain or deny
it.
But there was no prior inconsistent statement because she never said anything. So how can you argue 806 applies?
I'm sorry?
How can you argue 806 applies here?
I don't understand.
You said that there was a prior inconsistent statement would have been admissible in 806, but there was no statement by her that this would be inconsistent with.
There was a statement in the sense that she had identified her uncle Richard as the person who had penetrated her and touched her in her vaginal area. Now, I think that...
Well, that doesn't make it inconsistent. That may be an accurate statement, but it doesn't make an inconsistent statement to bring in Rule 806.
If she identified in her video testimony, for example, that her Uncle Rich was the person that digitally penetrated her,
right.
Which I think we can...
Let's say that's accurate.
Yes.
Tell me how the rule applies. She made an incorrect statement, but it's not inconsistent with anything else she said, so 806 doesn't come into play. Whether it's accurate or not, truthful or not, will be for the jury or for another type of objection, perhaps. But 806 deals with allowing statements in there inconsistent with a prior statement. There was no prior inconsistent statement as to denying that anyone else did it. She just said her uncle did it.
She said that the inconsistency comes because she said that, first of all, she said that Darren was the only person that touched her in a bad touch part. And secondly, when she was asked if anyone else touched her there, she said no. And that is inconsistent with the concept that her uncle then touched her in a bad touch part.
You're saying that the jury had a right to draw an inference from her statement that DS did a bad touch, that he was the person who had digitally penetrated her. That's the inference that you wanted the jury to draw. No?
Third-party guilt evidence doesn't have to line up exactly. It just has to create a possibility of reasonable doubt.
Okay.
We don't have to prove that this was exactly the same exact behavior. First of all, I think that we can agree that...
Okay, why did you want to introduce... What was the purpose that you wanted to introduce the statement made to DeAngelis? What was the purpose? It was obviously to undermine the credibility of the witness, correct?
And it was also to point out the fact that Sherry did not originally make this accusation against...
What does third-party guilt mean? It means that someone other than the defendant is guilty of having committed an offense, no? Or does it mean something else?
Yes, it would mean in this particular case that the person who touched her was Darren, not defendant.
Okay.
I thought that your point in with regard to the statement to DeAngelis was that the comment by Sherry was that Darren or whatever, the stepbrother, and only the stepbrother, did the bad touch, bad part touch.
Yes.
The word only was I thought, the significant part of the underscoring in that statement.
Yes, and when she was asked whether anyone else had touched her in a bad touch part, which I think we can agree in the context of a grown man digitally penetrating a child, that she would process that as being touched in a bad touch part, she said no. So if she said no one else than Darren, then that is inconsistent with the statement that she made later that her uncle did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you also wanted to suggest inferentially that if anyone touched her in a bad way, it was the stepbrother.
Yes.
That would have been a right for the
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a question about whether or not a proper foundation had been laid for the inquiry under the evidence rule, 613. So on cross-examination, S.H. was asked if she remembered telling the man from Dyfus that it was D.S. and only D.S. who had touched her. And she said no, she didn't remember. So, I mean, any further questioning on that would have been absolutely futile, correct?
Yes.
And if the defense attorney had tried to load up a leading question and say, isn't it a fact that you said to DeAngelis that DS was the only one who touched you, there would have been screams from the prosecutor's aisle. No?
Yes.
That point, because that was the very thing that the judge said could not come out before the jury.
Yes. Excuse me, Your Honor. The judge said that afterwards. He said that afterwards, though. But I certainly do agree with you that the prosecutor would have jumped all over the concept that defense counsel was badgering.
And the
you
other
can't
thing.
Refresh recollections without recollection without objection. Say, are you sure that that's the only time? You're not allowed to try to refresh the witness's recollection. Somehow that's objectionable.
In this particular case, the primary way that the attorney could have refreshed the recollection would have been with the Dyfus report. That, if we had an adult on the stand, would have been the normal way to hand the adult.
He wasn't required to do that. He asked the question whether she remembered, and in addition, the defense attorney was not permitted to cross-examine the witness on a document that she did not sign or produce herself, could not cross-examine her on that, correct?
He was not permitted to.
Right.
So we're dealing with a child witness reluctant in presenting testimony in this case. Would you agree?
Yes, very much.
And there were other parts where this witness as in other cases, said, I don't remember. You're not suggesting that's the end of any inquiry, because indeed that's not actually what happened in this case. There was a passage on direct where she claimed not to remember, and followed by two pages of questions that built up to her identification of the defendant. My point is, the words, I don't remember, don't necessarily end all inquiries, or is that what you're suggesting to us?
I'm not suggesting that, but I think that when we have a child witness, that defense counsel obviously dances around and tries to be more careful. And I also think that under the rule, under 613, the concept of 613 is that evidence, extrinsic evidence, is allowed to come in, and that only when the judge in his or her discretion determines that it cannot, then the evidence is excluded, perhaps because the witness was not allowed to explain or deny it. But that discretionary decision would have to be made in the context of recognizing that this evidence was important third-party guilt and confrontation evidence.
It wasn't going to come out anyway. The judge eventually made a ruling that it was irrelevant whether she showed her the report to refresh her recollection. If she was about to answer the question, there would have been an objection, and the judge would have sustained it, because we know that the judge ruled that it was irrelevant. Am I mistaken?
No, you're exactly correct.
So, all these questions are dancing around the final legal question, is whether or not it was impermissibly kept from the jury, because eventually the judge was going to keep it from the jury, whether her recollection was refreshed or not. Am I mistaken?
No, not at all.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
I would like to just make a comment about a couple of things. One is that there was this this argument from the state that somehow or another, and it was repeated in the appellate division's decision, that somehow or another, DeAngelis's interviewing was not forensic. It should not have been admitted. We shouldn't take her responses as meaning very much because his interview of her was not forensic. And as the court knows, that forensic just means having to do with coming to court. And the Dyfus worker was interviewing her in the context of eliciting evidence to bring to court for Dyfus to determine whether or not it would file a complaint of abuse or neglect, or guardianship or care and supervision, termination. So to say that he didn't have specialized training, he listed that he had specialized training in child abuse investigations. So to say that somehow or another his questioning was the evidence he elicited was somehow worth less or should not be given the same consideration as the evidence that that Woodfield elicited, I believe is incorrect.
DeAngelis did testify.
He did testify.
He was just prevented from testifying to this piece of evidence that the defendant wanted to introduce as third-party guilt.
Yes. Yes.
Two quick things. Regarding the harmless error argument that the state makes about the case involving S, is the video of the defendant's statement in the record before us where the individual transcript says shakes head in denial?
Of the defendant's statement?
Yeah.
None of the videos were given to the appellate division. And I did not file a motion to expand the record to include those for the court here.
If the court accepts your argument and reverses on the conviction as relates to S, what impact does that have on the other counts and the sentence?
That was another point. I'm sorry. I would like to bring up the
Please.
Fact that The appellate division said that this only affects the conviction relating to Sherry. First of all, defendant's point was in his appellate brief and now is that he was denied a fundamentally fair trial. These accusations were so linked. The whole trial was back and forth. Did you see this? Did you saw it when this happened to your sister? Did you or didn't you? And the testimony and the evidence for both children was presented at the same time. It was very clear that the state was bolstering one set of accusations with the other set of accusations. They were completely inextricably linked in this particular case.
Questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I'd like to make two major points. The first addresses the role that confrontation and compulsory process play in the analysis here as compared to the rules of evidence. And the other is the import of the excluded statement. So turning first to the question of compulsory process and confrontation, I think the state's argument in its brief, this is found at page 29, really misunderstands the role that the constitutional analysis plays here. The right of a defendant to present evidence, to present a defense, is fundamental. And it's found in both confrontation and in compulsory process. Confrontation, of course, has two different sides to it. It has both kind of the shield and the sword. And so the shield is in the cases like Crawford, where the state seeks to admit a statement, and the defendant says, no, that to admit that statement without giving me the right to cross-examine would violate my right to confrontation. And around those cases, courts have said, look, if you can exclude that statement based on the rules of evidence, then do so and don't get to the Confrontation Clause analysis. That's basic principles of constitutional avoidance. And that's what the state proposes you do here. But that constitutional avoidance has no role in a case where it's being used to say, I want to put forward evidence. Because that's the very point, is that the rules of evidence, the rigid adherence to the rules of evidence, is depriving the defendant of his right to present a defense. So you can't say, well, if the rules of evidence decide it, then that's it, because that would lead to a different result in Davis v. Alaska, and Garin, and Gunther. All of those cases say, no, when we stick to the rules, we might violate the defendant's right to present a defense. So that's point one. Point two is state points to other cases of third-party guilt and say, look, we've excluded third-party guilt evidence before, and it hasn't been reversible. But in each of those cases, what we've been dealing with is some guilty but not guilty of the crime sort of behavior, where if the jury believed it, they didn't have to, it wasn't going to undermine their confidence in the fact that the defendant had committed the underlying crime. So whether we're talking about someone wearing a similar sweater in Jimenez, or undated, unknown DNA in Perry, or whether we're talking about the threatening phone calls and loud car in Kodatich, none of those comes close to what we have here, which is a statement by the complaining witness that that someone other than the defendant touched her in a bad touch place, and critically, no one else did. And that's why this doesn't fit neatly into a third-party guilt box, because it is both the suggestion that D rather than RY digitally penetrated her, but also that maybe no one did. Because she specifically says, if you infer, that the defendant did not touch her. When she says only one person did it, by exclusion, that means the defendant did not. That is a piece of evidence that is extremely powerful. Now, the state aptly points out all the ways that they might have undermined that. They could talk about the differences in the interviewing techniques. They could talk about the vagaries of what a bad touch place means. Those are all good points. And no one is saying that the state has to accept the defendant's proffer of this information without cross-examination or without calling a rebuttal witness or without argument. They can do all of those things, but what they can't do is ask the judge to exclude the evidence. That puts the thumb on the scale of justice in a way that the Confrontation Clause and the Compulsory Process Clause forbid. last point, is that the state says, but look, there's none of these cases that talk about compulsory process or third-party guilt allow for automatic admissibility of evidence. Totally true. No one's suggesting that judges don't still get to exclude irrelevant evidence or duplicative evidence, but that's not what we have here. Here we have highly probative evidence, a single witness, it wasn't going to confuse the jury. The rationale for keeping this out at base was it was bad for the state, and that's not a basis to overcome the powerful interests that are animating the Confrontation Clause and the Compulsory Process Clause.
Mr. Shalom?
Yes.
Confrontation Clause protects the defendant's rights under the Constitution.
Yes, it does.
In this case, the defendant wanted to bring the statement in. So I don't understand your Confrontation Clause violation argument.
Well,
because it's the defendant who wants to bring it in, not the state as a witness, but rather the defendant. So I don't see how the Confrontation Clause applies to that.
Right. And so what the courts have said over time from Davis and Chambers is that together, the Confrontation Clause and the Compulsory Process Clause create this right of the defendant to present a defense. Sometimes it's through cross-examination. That's in confrontation.
Compulsory, I understand, but I just don't understand a confrontation, how that applies.
Well, really, they're related here because what the defendant wanted to do was ask on cross-examination, ask the complaining witness on cross-examination, did you say this? And then when she denied, which I believe that saying, I don't remember, effectively was a denial, to then be able to confront her with, through the Compulsory Process Clause, the testimony of the...
That's a little different
definition
than I
have. It's fine
to
call it compulsory process. I don't think it changes the analysis. What it is it's about the defendant's fundamental right to present a defense.
Well, what do you think would have happened had the defendant asked the question, S.H., didn't you say to Mr. DeAngelis, and then that the only person who did a bad touch was DS.
Right.
What do you think would have happened?
It's totally clear that the state would have objected, and Ms. Romeo is correct that the order of things was a little weird, which is mm-hmm. this happened, and then later the judge issued his opinion where he kept it out for lots of reasons, including the rape shield, which it seems like the state has abandoned appropriately, but that statement wasn't coming in. And so when you think about trials as largely credibility determinations, you're talking about the credibility of witnesses, but lawyers have to maintain their credibility too. And so if this lawyer is throwing out...
Had he done that, the judge might have calmed down on him or her, whoever, like a ton of bricks.
And if the judge didn't, so
maybe
the jury
judge
certainly
said,
would
have. Wrong and changed his mind if the attorney would have tried to approach the judge's sidebar and said, Judge, you got this wrong. Then necessarily, the judge might not have come down like a ton of bricks. He could have said, maybe I was wrong.
It is certainly possible that the judge would have reversed the three bases for exclusion that were later given. But I think we have no reason to believe that's true. And it asks a lot of a defense attorney to take that chance, to throw it out there in the hope that the judge might change their mind. That seems like an unfair burden.
Particularly asking that type of leading question after the witness said she had no recollection. The attorney might have been charged with asking a question in bad faith.
And putting on top of that, this is a child witness. These are incredibly difficult witnesses to examine, and I think lawyers appropriately are cautious in how they ask questions to child witnesses.
What do you say to the harmless error question that was asked by the Chief Justice of your colleague?
I think I want to defer mostly to the public defender on that, given her familiarity with the record. But what I will say is, in cases that are tried like this, it is very hard to separate out the credibility of one from the credibility of the other. Again, I think that's going to be fact-intensive, and I don't feel like I have sufficient familiarity with the facts to say more, but I've certainly seen enough cases where it's kind of the cumulative evidence that leads the jury to believe all the allegations, and it's not as easily segregable as the state's brief suggests it might be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Brigham.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The state has six main points in response that mainly focuses on Sherry's out-of-court statements and how defendant wasn't deprived of a fair trial here. First, the limitation of the caseworker's testimony has no impact on the convictions pertaining to Brianna. Brianna's spontaneous disclosure to her mother, consistent disclosures to the caseworker and detective, and trial testimony were corroborated by the tear on her labia, which the nurse examiner testified was consistent with digital manipulation, as well as the admissions in defendant's police statement. Second, the judge properly exercised his discretion in limiting the caseworker's testimony. Sherry's out-of-court statements, which defendant conceded he was seeking to offer for their truth, were admissible hearsay not subject to an exception. The statements were not prior inconsistent statements for two reasons. One, Sherry testified on cross that she did not remember making the statements. And two, Sherry's statements about Darren were not inconsistent with her testimony that defendant touched her private with his finger. Importantly, the caseworker never established what Sherry thought a bad touch was, nor determined what Sherry meant by bad touch part. As a result, she could have been referring to Darren, a 9-year-old child, pulling her hair, or giving her a wet willy in the ear, which she stopped doing after she told him to stop. But as Sherry's forensic interview shows, it did not mean that Darren, a 9-year-old child, was the person who stuck his finger in her vagina. Just 2 hours after Sherry's DCPP interview, she disclosed to the detective that defendant had touched inside her special spot under her clothing with his finger and that he had done this many times. Based solely on Sherry's out-of-court statements, given the trial evidence, it did not rationally engender reasonable doubt that it was Darren, a 9-year-old child, not defendant, who touched Sherry's vagina with his finger. The judge therefore properly exercised his discretion in ruling that the statements were inadmissible as third-party guilt evidence, in addition to being inadmissible hearsay. Third, because of the overwhelming trial evidence, the limitation of caseworker's testimony was not capable of producing an unjust result. This evidence included Sherry's disclosure to her mother immediately after Brianna, the defendant does it to her too. Sherry's disclosures to the detective just 2 hours after her DCPP interview, where she demonstrated how defendant touched her on a doll. Sherry's testimony and defendant's admissions in his police statement that he was alone with the girls in the morning 3 days per week and stuck his fingers in both girls. Fourth, the limitation of the caseworker's testimony did not violate defendant's confrontation or compulsory process rights. The confrontation clause is satisfied when the declarant is present at trial to defend or explain the statement and defendant is afforded the opportunity to cross-examine on the core allegations contained in it. And here, defendant conceded at oral argument on the state's motion that he cross-examined Sherry on core issues, including Sherry's out-of-court statements. What's more, the statements were non-testimonial under Buddha because the caseworker was gathering information to assure Sherry's future well-being, not to fuel prosecution. As for the compulsory process clause, if defendant was determined to argue that his 9-year-old stepson had stuck his finger in Sherry's vagina, he could have questioned Sherry directly on what she meant by the statements instead of seeking to admit inadmissible hearsay through the caseworker. Only cross-examining Sherry could ascertain the truth of what she meant by her statements. Fifth, the judge also properly exercised his discretion in allowing the state to ask the child sexual assault victims a few leading questions. This court has consistently held for over 60 years of the appropriateness of asking child witnesses leading questions and has already adequate safeguards in place to monitor this practice. It should not impose further limits under this case's circumstances. Finally, because of the overwhelming trial evidence, the girls, that includes the girls' forensic interviews, disclosures to their mother, and trial testimony, defendant's admissions in his plea statement, and the tear on Brianna's labia, any trial error defendant has raised is not capable of producing an unjust result.
Now, so are you suggesting that once Sherry said, I don't remember, that's the end of it? That seems to be what you're suggesting. What about Rule 612, past recollection refreshed? Or 803.5, past recollection recorded? What about those rules in order to either refresh recollection or past recollection recorded? Why isn't that DeAngelis would have testified that she told him that the only bad touch had been made by Dan, no, and not the defendant. But once he says, I don't remember that, that's the end of the inquiry?
No, that's not the end of the inquiry. The state's point is that the defendant could have directly questioned Sherry about what she meant by those statements. He could have also refreshed her recollection with the DCPP caseworker's report, which was a summary of the statements she had made to the caseworker.
And if she had said, I don't recall making that statement, that's the end of it? You can't call the DCPP worker to say that's exactly what she told me, I recorded it accurately? Under 803C5?
Under these cases, circumstances, no. Because what defendant was trying to do was trying to admit hearsay through the caseworker. And because he was trying to admit hearsay to the caseworker, that's why those statements were properly excluded. And here, defendant didn't meet the hearsay exception for a prior and consistent statement for two reasons. Not only because she stated that she didn't remember, which Brown...
That doesn't end the inquiry. That would be the end of every inquiry. If someone says, I don't remember, that's the end of it?
Well, the second reason is that the statements were inconsistent. Because
they were inconsistent. She said that it was the defendant, R.Y., who did it. And in the statement to the caseworker, she said it wasn't R.Y., it was Dan. So that is very inconsistent. I don't know how you can say that that's inconsistent.
That's not exactly what she said.
She told me that only Dan had made a bad touch on her, not defendant. That's at the appellate division opinion, page 5.
That statement needs to be read in context with how that statement transpired.
Isn't that for counsel to tease out in the course of the trial? Shouldn't a jury be entitled to hear this?
Well, here we're also dealing with the admissibility standard for third-party guilt evidence, which states that the evidence has to rationally engender reasonable doubt. In order to determine that, we have to look at all the trial evidence.
You would agree that if this is a reference to touching in the child's private parts, it directly negates guilt of the defendant.
If it is. But here it wasn't clear what that was because it was never established what Sherry meant by bad touch or bad touch part.
Do you think from reading this paragraph that it is reasonable, I'm looking at the DeAngelis report, to conclude that she's talking about her cousin touching her hair?
The state gave those two examples.
In context, is that a fair inference to draw from this series of passages?
It's a reasonable inference to draw from this passage that the bad touch that a 9-year-old child was doing on Sherry could have been pulling her hair or giving her a wet willy, or as was testified at the 104 testimony, it could have been a pinch or punch. And as the caseworker testified, based on his questions here, he didn't know what Sherry meant by bad touch. And in the caseworker report, he actually told he stated in the caseworker report that he told the detective that Sherry didn't disclose. So even the caseworker didn't think what Sherry said here necessarily meant that it was in reference to digital
You spoke about a rational inference. The rational inferences to be drawn from the evidence is typically for the jury. So I'm looking at DeAngelis' report. Werke asked SH if she would point, and she did not want to. Werke said that he understands, asked if anyone has ever touched her in the bad part. And she said, yes, it was her cousin. I can continue to read this. Now, you're saying, that bad touch may have been pulling her hair or wet willy. In context, given what she allegedly told the mother and allegedly what she told the detective afterwards, why wouldn't it be a rational inference that the bad touch was to a private part?
It wasn't clear that that's what Sherry meant. And based on the other
trial... Is it
that
for the jury to decide what she meant when you have a reasonable inference that are drawn by the jury based on the jury charges that are given every day? It's not for the judge to bar it and say, here's the reasonable inference I draw. It's for the jury.
If defendant had met the third party, the admissibility standard for third party guilt, yes, it would have been for the jury to decide. But here, the judge properly exercised his discretion in ruling that the third party guilt standard had not been met because it didn't engender reasonable doubt given the other trial evidence,
so
which included
factor in the passage that precedes the damning statement that the worker asked S if she knew where the bad touch was and she became silent and would not answer. Doesn't that suggest we're not talking about innocent pinching or hair pulling?
Not necessarily, because there's also evidence that Sherry was very reserved, that didn't open up to strangers, and had a processing disorder. So it could also be a rational inference that the caseworker just didn't wait long enough for Sherry to actually answer.
That's one inference. So that's an inference that you would argue to the jury. And as counsel said, might be perfectly plausible. Jury could accept it, jury could reject it. But isn't that a typical jury question to draw the inferences and not for the court or for the prosecutor to only draw them on for one side?
Again, Your Honor, if defendant had met the third party guilt admissibility standard, and here the state submits that the judge properly exercised his discretion in ruling that he did not, given the other trial evidence, which included the forensic interview just done 2 hours after the caseworker interview.
So let's take that. I wanted to stop in terms of the accounts that SH gave. And tell me if I'm mistaken about this, because you said that SH told the detective that it happened many times, correct?
In the forensic interview, yes.
In the forensic. But to DeAngelis, she said it happened once, and tell me if I'm mistaken. At trial, she said it happened only once. Am I mistaken about that? She said it happened only once on her sister's birthday.
You're not mistaken,
So these are, I'm only bringing these out because there isn't a continuity to the statements here. The statements are inconsistent in various different ways, and the question is whether or not the jury gets to decide those inconsistencies.
Again, the state reiterates the point that the standard review here is for abuse of discretion, and that the defendant did not meet the third-party admissibility standard for third-party guilt.
Are you still pressing your rape shield law claim argument? In asking that, is this really the kind of evidence that the legislature was trying to exclude when it enacted the rape shield law?
To answer your question, no, the state isn't completely abandoning its rape shield argument. I have three responses. The first is why the state didn't address rape shield in its supplemental brief is because the state's arguing that these statements are not sexual, and therefore, since they're not ex-sexual, they can't be within sexual conduct within the meaning of the rape shield.
Well, let me ask a better question. Okay. Is the rape shield law intended to exclude evidence that would directly point to a third party's guilt in the very incident that we're talking about here? Not talking about the past of the victim or prior sexual activity or insinuations before a jury along those lines, but in talking about the possible third-party guilt of someone with respect to the actual incident that occurred here, is that what the statute bars?
It depends, Your Honor. So in Perry, this court dealt with the interplay of rape shield and third-party guilt evidence and analyzed the semen stain under both standards. They weren't mutually exclusively. One didn't preclude the other. So it depends on the circumstances. Under this case circumstances, defendant is trying to use the statements to the caseworker as that Darren did it besides defendant. And for the same exact sexual act. And for that, that's why rape shield.
We said in Garin, the State versus Garin, that the rape shield can never keep out evidence that is necessary for the defense. When evidence is necessary for the defense, such as third party guilt, the rape shield clause never comes into play. Am I mistaken about that? As long as when evidence is necessary and relevant for the defense to make its case, the rape shield is not a bar. How could it be a bar to third-party guilt? The rape shield does not deny a defendant his or her right to defend him or herself in court.
So Garin applied a two-step analysis. The first step was relevancy and probativeness for a defense, but the next step that the court still had to analyze the issue under was still prejudice within the meaning of the rape shield.
You could still exclude prejudicial evidence under the rape shield even if the defendant is contending it's relevant in some situations.
Correct.
Of course.
Yes.
The rape shield was intended to keep out evidence about a woman's past, that she was promiscuous or loose and stuff of that nature, stuff that is totally irrelevant and unfair. It was intended to keep out evidence that would besmirch the reputation of the victim. Totally inappropriate. This is a case where the defendant is trying to introduce evidence that someone else may have committed the offense other than himself. Totally different. No?
The state isn't arguing that given the defendant's interpretation of the statements that rape shield excludes them. However, there is a third context. If this court was to interpret that in reference to the caseworker's statements that Darren was referring to a completely different sexual act apart from the digital manipulation that defendant was convicted of. Under that context, that separate sexual act as to Darren would be excludable under the rape shield because it would be sexual conduct under the statute's meaning, and then it would have to go through the two-step analysis.
So you're right, except in the statement, if you believe DeAngelis, there's a report. He said it happened only once.
So the state still submits that the statements weren't sexual in nature when Sherry was referencing to the bad touch as to Darren. And the reason for that is, and it has to be viewed within the context of the caseworker report and the other trial evidence, which included the forensic interview just done 2 hours later, where the detective was specially trained in finding words and was careful in pinpointing the exact terms that Sherry uses to refer to her different body parts. She referred to her genital area as a special spot, and after doing that, the detective asked whether there was any body part that nobody was ever supposed to touch. When she identified her special spot, when she asked her if anybody had touched her in her special spot, she referred to Uncle Rich, the defendant, and later disclosed that he touched inside under her clothing with his finger. Given that context, That's the reason why the defendant didn't reach the third party guilt stand the the admissibility standard for third-party guilt, because given the other trial evidence, it didn't rationally engender reasonable doubt.
You keep saying rationally engender reasonable doubt, but under Cotto, doesn't it talk about the possibility of reasonable doubt?
I'm not sure to honestly answer your Honor's question, but this court recently stated in Perry that the standard, and it said a defendant may introduce evidence of third-party guilt if the proof offered has a rational tendency to engender a reasonable doubt with respect to an essential feature of the
case. At Cotto, at page 332, we said the standard doesn't require evidence, quote, that substantially proves the guilt of another, but provides evidence that creates the possibility of reasonable doubt. Do we have a little ambiguity in our law, do you suggest?
And I don't suggest you have ambiguity in the law. Lofton also states that the reason why we have this admissibility standard is because of the danger that this kind of evidence can infect the process. And Cotadish also says that the evidence that the defendant seeks to omit can't be subject to mere conjecture.
But it's a fairly low standard. I'm looking at, and Justice Levesque has given one iteration. We've given various iterations. In Sturdivant, it was, and I'm quoting, somewhere in the total circumstances there must be some thread capable of inducing reasonable men to regard the event as bearing upon the state's case. And in another part of Sturdivant, a defendant's proofs must be capable of demonstrating some link between the third party and the victim or the crime. It's not a really high standard, would you agree, for the introduction of third party guilt?
The
standard is what it is.
The standard is what it is.
And you have to satisfy that standard.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. And also,
can I ask you a different question? Unless you've caught your thought, go ahead. If you want to complete,
you can ask me a different question.
Without surrendering your argument, I'd like you to address what your colleague did briefly: harmless error with regard to S, and if the court reverses that conviction, the impact on the balance of the case and sentence.
Okay. First, harmless error as to S, which I'm going to call her Sherry. That's the fictitious name that I used in the brief. There was overwhelming trial evidence. First, we had her spontaneous disclosure with her mother after Brianna stated that she pointed to her genital area and stated the defendant touches her down there. Sherry immediately said that defendant touches her there too, to the effect of that. Then we have her forensic interview, which happened just 2 hours after the caseworker interview, where Sherry stated, she stated that defendant had touched inside her special spot under her clothing with his finger, and that's at the defendant's appellate division appendix, day 34 to 35, that this happened many times. The defendant touched his private spot under his pants while touching her, and she also demonstrated on an internally correct doll how defendant touched her. We then have Sherry's testimony that she testified that a boy who was big touched her private with his finger at his house where she was babysat, and it hurt her a little. And a cite for that in the record is 1958-14 to 59-12. The fact that she stated in her forensic interview many times versus only once at trial is not unusual when a child is sexual assault victim is testifying about what happened to them. So Garrison states that young children often do not think in terms of dates or times, and that DR also states that their testimony is often affected by the stress of the courtroom and the defendant sitting right there. In addition to her trial testimony, we have the nurse examiner's testimony that although the same exam may have not found an injury on Sherry, that was also common because of the quick healing properties of a child's vaginal tissue.
Isn't that basically a neutral? You know, obviously, as to the other child, there was a finding on the medical examination, but as to there was a lack of finding. It wasn't that there may not have found been a finding. There was a lack of finding with respect to this child.
There was a lack of a finding, but the nurse examiner also testified as an expert that that was common,
right,
given the quick healing properties of the vaginal tissue and the angle that the digital penetration or the other sexual... The digital
she was testifying to say that that does not mean there was no assault.
Correct, yes. And that goes to the harmless error analysis. We also have the admissions and defendant's statement where he admitted he was alone with the girls in the morning 3 days per week. He acknowledged that all he did was stick his fingers in the girls, and that he answered that if he were to write a note to the girls, he would say to both girls that he was sorry, he scared or hurt them. So he's also admitting to digitally penetrating Sherry in his police statement.
So I think looking at this transcript that some of the strongest evidence is what appears at page 15. Did you ever see do anything other than stick your fingers in both of them? And next... It reads in parens, shakes head no. That's all you did? Nods head yes. What is a reviewing court to make of that?
Well, the court...
The it's not on the record.
So defendant was also... the state also crossed defendant because he testified here, and on cross, defendant testified that although he initially shook his head to the effect of this, although he initially shook his head no, when asked if he did it to Sherry too, defendant acknowledged that when he nodded his head yes, later in his video recorded statement, he was agreeing that he stuck his fingers into both Brianna and Sherry.
Can you give us the citation for that?
Yes. It's 12T130-7 to 20-23.
What are you reading from?
I'm paraphrasing. The defendant's cross-examination testimony where he's interpreting what his nod of his head.
You said 130-7 to what?
130-7 to 23. And the transcript is 12T.
Okay.
And if the conviction is reversed as to S?
Right. If the conviction as to Sherry is reversed, it should have no impact on defendant's sentence because here defendant was sentenced to two concurrent 20-year terms as to the first-degree aggravated assault for Sherry and for Brianna.
But I think they're making a different argument. They're making an argument that he's entitled to a retrial on everything, if I understand their argument, not sentencing.
He should not be entitled to a retrial on everything because the evidence was even more overwhelming for defendant's digital manipulation of Brianna. As to Brianna, we have her spontaneous disclosure. We have her her forensic interview where she told the detective that she does not like touches by Uncle Rich when he sticks far in her private area with his fingers at his house. That's at DA 17 to 18 of the defendant's appellate division appendix. She explained that when the abuse happened to her, Darren was in his bedroom asleep. That's at DA 20 to 21. At trial, she testified that she was touched in her private area by a big person who was a boy at his and Cindy's house, and that the person who touched her was Darren's daddy. That's at 1944-1 to 45-21. We also have the physical evidence, the tear on Brianna's labia, and the nurse examiner's testimony, expert testimony, that was consistent with digital manipulation. And that same exam was conducted just 2 days after she was babysat at defendant's apartment. So that's the evidence as to Brianna and why the convictions as to her should remain. And if her the convictions as, and speaking hypothetically, if the convictions as to Brianna remain but they were reversed as to Sherry, it should have no effect on the sentence, because as I was explaining before, a 20-year sentence was imposed for the conviction for the first-degree aggravated sexual assault as to Brianna, and that was not manifestly excessive for a few reasons. So excluding Sherry's convictions, defendant was exposed to a maximum term of 40 years in prison. The judge found that the aggravating factors 2, 3, and 9 successfully outweighed the mitigating factor 7. And under Fuentes, this court has said that one reasonable approach that a sentencing judge may take to sentencing is using the middle of the range as a logical starting point. And here, the aggravating factors clearly preponderated over the mitigating, so it was appropriate to sentence him at the high range. And the state also points out that although the Jessica Lunsford Act wasn't in effect at the time of defendant's crimes, if he was convicted of those same crimes today, he would be facing a minimum term of 25 years in prison.
Other questions, anyone?
No.
I think we have your position, counsel. Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. I'll take the matter under advisement. We're just going to take a brief